Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome and good evening to our program this evening. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm from the Independent Institute. Our program tonight is a special one. I'm delighted to welcome all of you here tonight. I'm sorry about the cramped quarters, but we have a capacity crowd. If any of you would prefer being a little more comfortable, you're welcome to watch the program also on closed circuit TV next door in the library or upstairs. The program that we're holding tonight is actually part of a series of lectures and seminars the Independent Institute sponsors on a monthly and bi-monthly basis on many different issues. For those of you new to the Institute, hopefully everyone got a copy of our packet, which will provide background on our program and many of the books that we publish, including on the issue that we're going to be discussing tonight. We are what's called a public policy research institute. We're an academic research institute, and as a result, we have many scholars and fellows at universities in the United States and around the world who are engaged in research in almost all of the social sciences. The program that we have tonight, as I said, is part of a series. In your packet, you'll find a sheet describing tonight's program, which also has a schedule of events coming up. For example, on October 20th, our program will focus on the topic of virtual money, privacy, and the internet. The speakers will be Dr. Richard Rahn, former chief economist for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and president of Novacon Corporation, who's author of the new book, The End of Money and the Struggle for Financial Privacy. We'll also be having Peter Thiel, who's the chairman and CEO of a company now involved in this field called Confinity. Peter has also been a research fellow at the Institute, and so it's nice to have him back. On November 17th, we will also be holding a program on the American Civil War. And the subtitle of that is Human Liberty and the Roots of American Leviathan. The speakers of that will be the historian Henry Mayers, who is author of the award-winning book All on Fire, subtitled William Lloyd Garrison and the Abolition of Slavery, and Jeffrey Rogers Hummel, who's professor of economics and history at Golden Gate University, is author of the book Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men. And part of the issue of this particular program is its relevance to modern debate. For this evening, we're indeed privileged to have two of the leading scholars and writers in the field of firearms and the Second Amendment and issues of violence and so forth. And it's really a treat to have them both here. Drawing on her acclaimed book, To Keep and Bear Arms, which I hope all of you have either had a copy or will be able to get one before you leave tonight, historian Joyce Malcolm will be examining the issues of ownership and use and control of firearms in civil society. As we all know, the school massacre in Littleton, Colorado, and the shooting of Jewish children in Los Angeles, as well as drive-by shootings and a host of other calamities and atrocities have gotten national attention, and it seems to be escalating. But the questions I think to ask are, how do we protect the innocent from violence in American society? Can government really protect the citizens against gun-related violence? What is the record of individual self-defense in Britain and the United States? In other countries? What is the record of gun control of different types? What's the historical basis of the Second Amendment? And the list goes on. Our second speaker will be civil rights attorney and criminologist Don Cates, who will be commenting on Professor Joyce's talk and discussing other aspects of these issues. Joyce Lee Malcolm is professor of history at Bentley College, visiting scholar in security studies at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and founder director of the New England Heritage Society Center. She's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. She received her PhD in history from Brandeis University. In addition, she's been a visiting fellow at Harvard Law School, Fletcher Jones Foundation Fellow at the Huntington Library, and many other distinguished positions. In addition to her book, To Keep and Bear Arms, she's the author of the book, Arms, Violence, and the Law, which is forthcoming from also from Harvard University Press, as well as the two-volume book, The Struggle for Sovereignty, Caesar's Due, and The Scene of the Battle, 1775. I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Malcolm, and this is your book.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here today. When I first started to study the origins of the right to bear arms, I was always being asked, how did a nice girl like you get interested in a subject like that? This is true, and I was always asked that. Nobody asks me that anymore. And it seems to me there are three possible reasons. Either because I'm not considered nice anymore, or not considered a girl anymore, and it's never been politically correct anyway to call me that. Or the third reason, which I would like to believe is the real reason, and that is because at this point people have realized that the right to bear arms is a serious subject, and in fact one of the most serious rights that people have, and that it deserves some respect. It isn't one of those unpleasant things that nice people don't talk about or study. There's evidence that I think this is the correct reason. And I'd like to just give you a sense briefly of the change in the attitude despite the recurring atrocities and the kind of press tempo and drumbeat after each of them that something needs to be done about guns. There has been a change in attitude toward the right. Now, looking back, in 1975, the American Bar Association, the most distinguished organization of the country's lawyers, appointed a committee to look into the legal basis for firearms ownership and the intent of the Second Amendment. And this committee in 1975 found that there was more disagreement and misunderstanding and controversy over this right than any other constitutional issue. But looking at the intent of the Second Amendment, they came to this conclusion, which they published in the report. It is doubtful that the Founding Fathers had any intent in mind with regard to the meaning of this amendment. They presumably put it in because they just needed one more. But the amazing thing is that, I mean, this was published in a serious report in the American Bar Association's reports for that year, and nobody seemed startled by this. In 1983, the Supreme Court refused to hear the Morton Grove case. Morton Grove was the town that had banned handguns, and it consistently refused to hear cases on the Second Amendment, and no federal court had ever held that a law that restricted guns violated anyone's Second Amendment rights. Lawrence Tribe, who's the most distinguished constitutional legal scholar in this country and teaches at Harvard Law School, wrote his classic textbook, American Constitutional Law, in 1978. He took 276 pages to talk about the First Amendment. I mean, really a book's worth, 276 pages. The Second Amendment got a footnote, not even in the section on rights, but it was in the section on the relationship between the federal government and the states. And he had this to say. He said that the congressional debates in that footnote indicate that the sole concern of the Second Amendment's framers was to prevent such federal interferences with state militia as would permit the establishment of a standing national army and the consequent destruction of local autonomy, thus the inapplicability of the Second Amendment to purely private conduct. 10 years later, in 1988, the second edition came out. The footnote was a little bit longer, added a little more, but basically had the same message. This is what the situation was up until the last few years. There's been a shift, and I'll give you some examples. There is an emergence now of what is called the standard model interpretation, based on quite a lot of the recent research that's been done, serious research. The new standard model, as it's called, is the concept that there is an individual right. It actually was the original model and is now the new standard model. Nelson Lund, who coined the expression, said, "The serious literature on the subject is virtually unanimous in concluding that the Constitution establishes an individual right." So it's very hard to get any serious scholarship where people find anything different. No, that's Nelson Lund. I'll get to Tribe. In 1997, the Supreme Court heard the Brady case, and it decided, of course, that the Brady law was unconstitutional, not on Second Amendment grounds, but on issues of what the federal government can require of the states. They never really were asked to decide on the Second Amendment. However, in his concurring opinion, Justice Thomas referred to the fact that the Second Amendment hadn't been an issue, but he wrote, "Marshaling an impressive array of historical evidence, a growing body of scholarly commentary indicates that the right to keep and bear arms is, as the amendment's text suggests, a personal right." And then he then listed my book and some things Don has done and various other people's. But I mean, he went out of his way to point out that there was this tremendous or impressive array of scholarship that now said that. And then he went on to say, perhaps at some future date, this court will have the opportunity to determine whether Justice Story was correct when he wrote that the right to bear arms has been justly considered as the palladium of the liberties of a republic. So he's basically inviting a case. In April of this year, a federal court did overturn a conviction and the taking away of someone's guns on the basis that their Second Amendment rights had been violated. And this was a federal court in Texas in April, and that case is now being appealed, so they can no longer say, I shouldn't say they can no longer. Last week in The Globe, they still insisted in an article that the Second Amendment didn't protect an individual right. They still insisted that no federal court had found that anyone's rights were ever violated, and Second Amendment rights, but nonetheless, there has been a decision. And last month, Lawrence Tribe, in the latest edition, every 10 years he comes out with a new one, the latest edition of his book, and these texts of his are extremely influential because this is the book that the law students across the country read and study in constitutional law. The Second Amendment has graduated from a footnote to 10 pages, 10 full pages, and it isn't easy for someone like Tribe, who has dismissed it for 20 years, to change his mind. He says of it, "The Second Amendment provides fertile ground in which to till the soil of federalism and to unearth its relationship with individual as well as collective notions of right. Few constitutional provisions offer a richer opportunity to sort out the strands of one's approach to constitutional interpretation." He concludes that the amendment recognizes a right on the part of individuals to possess and use firearms in the defense of themselves and their homes, although he says this isn't clear what the parameters are and that more study needs to be done. For this change, which is substantial and was only last month in his new book, he has already gotten substantial hate mail from his former supporters. But it's interesting because, the American people have always believed that they had a constitutional right to be armed, and all of these surveys have found that overwhelmingly they believe that. And yet the legal experts in the 20th century have found numerous ways to interpret and misinterpret and nullify that individual right. The arguments still continue despite all of the evidence that's been brought out. And I think the reason is clear, that behind the Second Amendment are people's views of how best to reduce crime and to make the streets safe, and the Second Amendment somehow has gotten in the way of all of that. Tribe makes a comment about it that I think is very telling. He refers to, in his words, the poignancy of the topic of gun control and the inescapable tension for many people on both sides of this policy divide between the reading of the Second Amendment that would advance the policies they favor and the reading of the Second Amendment to which intellectual honesty and their own theories of constitutional interpretation would drive them if they could bring themselves to set their policy convictions aside. And I have great respect for the man for saying that, for at least coming out and saying, you know, that there's people's policy issues have kept them from being intellectually honest about what the evidence seems to be saying. What I have done is to investigate the English legal tradition that the colonists had and the way that the English people developed this right and passed it on to America as a way of understanding what the Second Amendment meant. I'd like to sort of briefly go through what I found out and then discuss the development of the Second Amendment, its language, and the modern dilemma. My current work is on the relationship between firearms and violence and the law in England, which is a somewhat different subject, but very important because there's a tremendous debate in this country about whether more guns means less crime or less guns means less crime, or whether guns have no relevance whatsoever to the crime rate, and I'm hoping that my studies of England will help to at least nail down the experience of that one country. But I'd like to just briefly go through this history, and I hope that in your questions afterwards you'll have an opportunity to quiz me about anything that I haven't done or that's not clear or that you find of interest. First of all, the English tradition was that the ordinary citizen had police duties. There were no police in Britain until the middle of the 19th century, and so everybody had a series of duties for which they absolutely were required to be armed. Your first duty was to protect yourself and your family, and in doing so, you were actually serving the public because you were preventing a felony. You were protecting yourself, but you were also keeping the peace. You had to take turns in villages standing watch, and people who, householders had to take their turns, and if they were unable to for some reason, they were disabled or could not, then you had to hire a substitute. If you saw crime being committed, you were to raise a hue and cry. You were not to turn and look the other way. In fact, if you did, you could be fined. You were to raise a hue and a cry and set out after the culprit. And the community was given 40 days in which to catch this person and bring them back to justice. Otherwise, the community had to make good half of any loss that the person who was robbed had suffered. So there's a real a real incentive to be involved. You were to join a sheriff's posse if you were called, and of course we're all familiar with the Western posse, but this was the origins of it. You were to set out with your equipment and help the sheriff. And often that meant leaving your community, going from town to town and county to county after wrongdoers. And then finally, you were, if you were a man between the ages of 16 and 60, liable to serve in a militia, a citizen army, and provide weapons, which you kept at home. Other people contributed weapons for the militia. And I'd just like to say that there's a lot of confusion, I think, about a militia tradition. The militia was not a voluntary organization. You were obliged to serve in the militia just like you might be conscripted to serve in an army. But it was felt to be a lot safer to have citizen soldiers than professional soldiers. The citizen soldiers were your neighbors. They would never do anything hostile to their community, whereas professional soldiers were regarded as having other interests and were often used by kings to solidify their own rights and take away people's rights. And this tradition is something that we have inherited from the English, and which I think, in fact, looking around the world today, makes a lot of sense. There are a tremendous number of countries that are ruled by their army or by someone who was formerly an army general, and once armies get involved in politics, it's extremely hard to get them out of it. So the militia was the English alternative, and they were unwilling, whenever possible, to tolerate an army, especially in a time of peace. Blackstone in 1765, in the 18th century, not long before the American Revolution, talked about the English army, and he said the army was to be looked on only as temporary exigencies bred out of the distemper of the state and not as any part of the permanent and perpetual laws of the kingdom. I'd like to just show you a few transparencies that show pictures of early guns to give you some sense of what they were like in these early days. Can you hear me okay? I've got a... Is that all right? Okay. This is
Oops. The other way. Here we go. That's good. Okay. This is a picture of the German monk who is credited or was credited by the Europeans with having come up with the invention of gunpowder. And the Europeans being Europeans, they immediately thought of how they could use it as a piece of military equipment. And this is, pictures of the very earliest firearm, which was called a hand cannon. It had a tremendous kick, and you notice these people are wearing armor. So this was back in the 14th century. That kind of loose stone was put in there and shot out. It made a tremendous amount of noise, and it created a lot of smoke. It was not very effective, but they kept working at it. They were sure that somehow there was an important weapon here. And in the 14th century, it got further developed so that it was a little bit safer. And in the 15th century, man got a little bit further from the match that had to light that gunpowder. It was still a very primitive weapon, handheld, but it was not quite so fatal to the person who was shooting it. And then in the 16th century, they came up with a matchlock rifle, which was an extraordinarily heavy one, far, far heavier than the rifle, the Brown Bess, that was used during the American Revolution. It had a long, heavy metal barrel. It took something like 43 steps in order to fire this. But again, despite the fact that it was extremely clumsy, heavy, expensive, and dangerous, it became the major weapon of the infantry. And these are some pictures of some of the maneuvers that you have to go through in order to fire it. There were a lot of problems with it. The long stick that soldier is holding, the musketeer, was to prop up this rifle because it was so heavy that you really had to kind of rest it in this notch. He has around his shoulder little pouches made of leather that hold measured amounts of gunpowder, and then you use the stick to prime it. He also has around his shoulder what's called match, and that was a long string that burnt very slowly that you would light the gunpowder with when you were all done getting this loaded. This is the final stages of propping it up. It was extremely ineffective as a weapon. If it rained, the match got wet and it wouldn't light. So you really did have to keep your powder dry and your match dry. If the gunpowder that he was busy sprinkling around didn't light right away, you had to either light it again with the possibility it might flare up at you or let it sputter out. He was surrounded with these little containers of gunpowder. He had gunpowder he was busy, you know, pouring in. He had match in his hand. And there were a lot of serious accidents because it was like being a huge bomb. Sometimes, too, the barrel itself would split. So it was a difficult weapon to use, but it had the wonderful advantage that it punctured armor and also horses. Not nice, but this is one of the early handguns. You notice this is someone in armor. The cavalry felt that they needed to have some kind of comparable weapon. It was not very effective. It's a bit lighter. And then this is one of my favorite. These are all from early military manuals. This one is called If at First You Don't Succeed. These are two musketeers firing at each other in that first picture. And then on the top frame on the right, they missed. So they're using their sticks, their guns, as clubs. In the middle, they're reduced to using their helmets to hit each other. And then the forked stick, which was made of metal, too, was always handy. And then the bottom, they've taken off their little belt full of these cartridges, pouches that held the gunpowder, and are hitting each other with that. And then finally, they just get reduced to fighting it out hand to hand. So that it had its problems, but it was a weapon with a lot of potential uses in all sorts of different ways. And then this was one very nice idea of how to use it. This is called the tree disguise. you could hide, although it's a rather strange-looking tree, and sneak up on the enemy with that. And then finally, this is a picture of a siege tower, which could be cranked up. And at the top, you notice there's someone with a musket on the left, and on the right, someone with a large stone. And what I like about this picture is it shows that as firearms are coming in, we still have the use of extremely primitive weapons side by side. So it sort of gradually kind of filters in while other weapons and armor are still being used. It took some time before armies shifted. In the 16th century, when you have this heavy matchlock musket, you begin to get lighter weapons that ordinary people use. And in England, there was no problem about people having these weapons because, in fact, they needed them for all of these peacekeeping duties. There were some restrictions, I should say, on handguns and crossbows, which were easily concealable. And in order to use a handgun, you were supposed to have income of a certain amount. However, it was a rule that was widely violated, and very few people ever seemed to get prosecuted for just having a handgun or a crossbow. There were religious restrictions because Catholics were believed to be potential subversives in the Protestant state. And there were game acts which allowed anyone who could not have an income and property to qualify to hunt game was not supposed to have a gun to hunt game. You could have a gun at home, but you weren't to use it in shooting animals. That was fine because most people who went poaching didn't want something as noisy as a gun anyway. And they did what they still do, and that is that they set nice quiet snares, and they could then come quietly later and pick up the animal. At any rate, during the middle of the 17th century, there was a great civil war between the king and parliament, and they fought over control of the militia and control of the weapons in the country. The king was overthrown, and Oliver Cromwell, who eventually took control, used the militia of that time to disarm his enemies, to disarm anyone who seemed suspicious. And after he died, the king was restored in 1660, Charles II, and he began to clamp down on firearms. They were everywhere. There had been a civil war. His father had been overthrown and executed, and he did not want to allow these weapons to be used by his enemies. So he had a militia, but it was what people then called a select militia. It was politically skewed. It was used to disarm anyone who was suspected of being potentially against the government. Gun makers had to report on sales, and imports were forbidden. There was a Game Act passed which actually prohibited anyone who did not have an income sufficient to hunt from even owning a gun. However, it doesn't seem ever to have been enforced by the country gentlemen and their gamekeepers who were supposed to enforce it. At any rate, in 1688, there sat on the throne of England James II, who was a convert to Catholicism and who wanted very much to control things with a standing army and to take away people's rights and convert them from the Protestant faith to his own. And at that point, some of the important people in the country sent for James's son-in-law, William of Orange, and his daughter Mary, who was a Protestant, and asked them to come save their religion and the rights of Englishmen. William and Mary came to England, and James fled. And a convention parliament, was called to put William and Mary on the throne. But before they did that, the people who were there felt that it was important to shore up their rights so that this kind of thing wouldn't happen again. They wouldn't have a king who tried to govern with an army, who tried to disarm his opponents. And in drawing up the English Bill of Rights, which was drawn up about 100 years before our own, they included for the very first time a right for people to have firearms. It read, "The subjects which are Protestant may have arms for their defense, suitable to their conditions and as allowed by law." When the first versions of this included the phrase "for their common defense,"
that people should provide arms for their common defense, and that was excluded in the last version of it, so that it came down as exclusively an individual right. The House of Lords had decided they wanted nothing to do with the common defense for fear that it meant arming the mob in some way. So it was very exclusively an individual right. The clauses at the end that people had this right suitable to their condition or their status and as allowed by law might have allowed for restrictions, but a series of court cases in the 18th century made it utterly clear that this was an individual right for all Englishmen. Catholics did not have the right, but nonetheless they were allowed to have weapons in their home for the defense of themselves and their families. So it wasn't a right, but it was basically something that they were permitted to have because they needed it. This individual right in 1765 was given a new interpretation by Blackstone when he published his Commentaries on the Laws of England, which and about 10 years before the American Revolution and was a very influential book in America. Blackstone said that it was important that this be a right, and he listed all the rights, but he said that these rights would be just basically what our founders would have called parchment barriers if there weren't other rights that enabled them to be enforced. And he called these auxiliary rights. One of them was having a parliament, and another was limits on the king's powers, appeal to the courts, petition to the king or parliament, and the last he said was the right to have arms. He called it the fifth right of the subject, having arms for their defense. He said it was a public allowance under due restrictions of the natural right of resistance and self-preservation when the sanctions of society and law are found insufficient to restrain the violence of oppression. In other words, the right of the people to be armed meant that not only could you protect yourself, but if there was ever some tyranny, it would enable the people to defend themselves and get back their rights. And so it had this second power to basically shore up their other rights. They never mentioned the militia in any of this. The militia was under the control of the government and wasn't the main source of power. It was the people who were to be able to vindicate their own rights. In America, the British tradition was copied. People were to protect themselves and their family. They actually had watches. And then in America, there was an even more broad right. There were no limitations based on religion. There was no limitation based on the type of weapon. The founding fathers and the earlier colonists were just happy to have people armed. And in fact, many of the colonies insisted that every household have a certain amount of weapons for everyone in that household. And there were certain laws that if you went beyond your own home and out into the countryside, you had to have weapons with you just in case of anything. So you were really responsible for protecting yourself and protecting your community. And there was a militia created, and again, it was sort of a citizen army and a defensive army, but it was under the control of the government, although the Americans tended to elect their own officers, which the English certainly didn't do. During the American Revolution, the Americans were very anxious about this British standing army and, of course, uneasy about the militia. I should say that the militia being under the control of the government, it was unsure what was to happen to it. The British officers and Gage had a right to disarm the American militia if they felt that they ought to. They didn't trust the militia because it was made up of American colonists. The colonists didn't trust the militia because the British had control of it, and so they founded the Minutemen as an alternative to the sort of established militia, and both sides kind of took the equipment from the regular militia. During the American Revolution, the states had to create their own constitutions, and many of them put in rights for people to be armed. After the Revolution, of course, our Constitution was eventually devised, and after the discontent the people had because there was no Bill of Rights, a Bill of Rights drawn up. There was not a lot of debate during the convention about the Second Amendment and exactly what it meant. But if you look at the different versions of the amendment and the comments that were made of it afterwards, it's quite clear that an individual right was intended. Of course, it reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Some people have claimed that this simply gave power over the militia back to the states. The Constitution spelled out what the powers were over the militia. The powers over the militia were very largely in the hands of the federal government, and the Second Amendment doesn't say anything about that, doesn't move that one way or the other, has really no impact on it, despite Tribe's first assertion about. They sometimes claim that it's just a guarantee that the militia will have a right to bear arms, but of course it doesn't say that. It doesn't say the right of the militia to keep and bear arms. It says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Some of the changes made make it very clear what they intended. They rejected the idea that the militia be well armed, and in fact that was left out. They rejected the notion that the militia be the body of the people, because that was in an earlier version and it was left out. The reason that the militia clause is in there was that they very much favored a militia over a professional army, but did not want to say anything that seemed to distrust the army that they were going to need, and which was also part of the Constitution. I think it seemed better to simply say that it was the militia that was the security, the necessary to the security of a free state. The most important proof that an individual right, not a common right, was intended was that the Senate was offered the phrase for the common defense to be added after to keep and bear arms. So it would have read that the people had the right to keep and bear arms for the common defense. If they had accepted that clause, then I think that the argument that it was just a collective right would have some ground. But they rejected that clause. They specifically left it out just as the English had in their right, coming down in favor of it being an individual right and not just for people to have for their common defense. There has been, of course, since the 20th century, a great parting of the ways between the English right and the American right. The English, because they don't have an entrenched constitution, have to depend on Parliament to protect their rights, and Parliament in 1920 passed a Firearms Act, which requires that if you want to have a gun and ammunition, you must go to your local police chief, and he has to decide that you are a fit person to have a weapon and have a good reason for having that weapon. As I say, this was passed in 1920 after World War I, and there was a great deal of fear that men coming back brutalized by the war would really be violent and revolutionary. There had been a recent revolution in Russia. They were afraid of a Bolshevik revolution spreading, and there was a large number of labor unions and planning general strike. So it was really not because of an increasing crime, it was for fear of revolution that this law was passed, and Parliament was told that law-abiding people wouldn't be bothered by this. And at first, of course, they weren't. But what happened was that over the years, the law stayed the same, but there were secret memorandums from the Home Office, like the Interior Department, to police chiefs across the country, telling them what constituted a good reason to have a weapon. And over the years, they decided that protecting yourself was not a good reason. This started gradually. It should almost never be a good reason. And then eventually, in 1969, they stated that it should never be accepted as a reason. What is a good reason, or what was a good reason to have a gun? If you belonged to a gun club, that was a good reason. If you were using it for sport, that was a good reason. But if you lived in a lonely spot, if you had a bank with money to protect or a shop, that was not a good reason. It was not considered a good reason ever to have a gun for protection. In 1953, the English went even further, and they passed something called the Prevention of Crime Act. And this act makes it a crime to have any implement whatsoever on you that you would use as an offensive weapon, which means that if someone attacked you, you could defend yourself with it. You cannot carry a walking stick for that purpose, or a wrench, or a pin, or anything. Doesn't have to be something that is a weapon per se. It can be anything that you would use to protect yourself. You then, if you're picked up by the police with such a weapon in your possession, have to prove yourself innocent. You're guilty till you prove yourself innocent. It would be illegal to carry the umbrella if you carried it for the purposes of using it against someone. If you carried it because it might rain, it would be legal. So it was a very, very strange, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about that. But they've gone to that extent. The result has been that since 1953, the English have had a rising rate of armed crime. They have been restricting and restricting firearms. In 1997, they banned virtually every type of handgun. And there was a hand-in of those handguns, the 60,000 or so that had been licensed, were handed into the government, and these people were supposed to be reimbursed. Despite that, despite the hand-in, despite these strict laws, there's been an increasing rate of violent crime in England. And at this point, an Englishman is nearly twice as likely to be mugged as an American. Nearly one and a half times as likely to be robbed. It's amazing. And not only are you more likely to be burgled in England, but 50% of their burglaries are what they call hot burglaries, when people are home. Whereas in America, it's something like 13%. In England, in America, clearly, people who want to rob you don't want you to be home for fear that you might make trouble. In England, they know you can't. They'd rather that you be home because then your alarm system is not on. The English government's theory about why this is a good state of affairs is that they feel that if people don't have weapons, then criminals won't feel they need to have them. This is the rationale for it. Yes. At any rate, I don't want to take all the time, but I just wanted to give you a sense of how far we have come in different directions. We have an estimated 200 million guns, although also an estimated 20,000 laws infringing our right to bear arms. I'm not sure about either of those figures, since there are an awful lot of zeros in there. However, starting with the same right, we've now gone to very different extremes. Just a final note, and that on the interpretation of the Second Amendment, because there's still a tremendous drumbeat for stricter and stricter gun laws. That seems a very nice, convenient way of doing something in the face of atrocities that occur to ban guns. And the reason that England was able to get that complete ban on handguns in 1997 was because of the Dunblane massacre in Scotland. There's a tremendous emotional response, and the government admitting that it wouldn't do anything to stop crime, nonetheless felt it had to do something, and so they banned all legal guns. However, we still have an extremely tough fight here, because despite the evidence of scholarship, a lot of people just don't want to recognize it. And I'd like to just close with a comment of our first Chief Justice, John Marshall, an opinion in 1827 on how we ought to interpret the Constitution. He said, to say that the intention of the instrument, the Constitution, must prevail, that this intention must be collected from its words, that its words are to be understood in that sense in which they are generally used by those for whom the instrument was intended, and that its provisions are neither to be restricted into insignificance, nor extended to objects not comprehended in them, nor contemplated by its framers, is to repeat what has already been said more at large, and is all that can be necessary. The Second Amendment has been very much in danger of being restricted into insignificance. And I hope that, you know, a serious look at the amendment and the concentration of people on this important right will rescue it from that fate. Thank you.